The Silmarillion is at the heart of Tolkien's legendarium, but what is actually in there? Let's take a look. Hi everyone, this is Robert. Welcome to In Deep Geek. On this channel, we cover Tolkien's legendarium in nerdy detail, as well as A Song of Ice and Fire and The Witcher. If you're new here, welcome. The Silmarillion is a collection of J.R.R. Tolkien's writings on Middle-earth, edited by Christopher Tolkien, with help from Guy Gavriel Kay and published after his death. It acts as a history of Middle-earth, from its creation through to the time and just after the events of The Lord of the Rings. It had been something Tolkien had wanted to publish during his lifetime, trying and failing to persuade his publishers to release it alongside The Lord of the Rings. But as he never finished a final version of it, and carried on amending and revising his creation right up to his death, Christopher Tolkien was left with an unenviable task in pulling it all together. While it is undeniably J.R.R. Tolkien's work, Christopher had to make a number of significant decisions about which version of his father's work to include, and in some cases even had to finish off some stories within it. Nevertheless, the Silmarillion is viewed as authoritative within the legendarium. It's written in a more formal, old-fashioned style than the two main Tolkien books we know, lending it a slightly more biblical feel, if that's the right word, and the combination of a narrative spanning millennia with hundreds of characters with often similar sounding names, and even the basic geography of the planet changing several times, many people don't find it an easy read. So don't worry if you have tried it and found it hard going, you're in good company. Okay, preamble out of the way, what is in the book? It's made up of five parts, so let's go through them in turn. The first part is called the Ainulindale, the Music of the Ainur. This is an account of the creation of the world by Eru, Ilúvatar, the one true god. He first made the Ainur, powerful spiritual beings who he taught to sing, and led them in a great song that, through Eru's flame imperishable, they could see. This was beautiful, but got disrupted by Melkor, who was later known as Morgoth, who sang discordant notes, even when Eru stopped and started the singing again a couple of times. Morgoth becomes the great enemy throughout the Silmarillion. He is hugely powerful, but jealous of Uru's ability to create things ex nihilo, and therefore wants to disrupt it. Anyway, Eru then showed the Ainur what it was that they were singing, basically the history of the world. He then created it, and many of the Ainur went down into this newly formed world. They became known as the Valar and Maiar. More about that in a moment, and were commissioned by Eru to form and prepare the world for the later coming of the children of Ilúvatar. That's elves and humans. Of course, Morgoth also descended into the world to oppose this, and there were a couple of massive wars, but eventually the world was set ready for the arrival of the elves, while an uneasy peace held between the Valar and Morgoth. The second part of the book is the Valaquenta, account of the Valar and Maiar, according to the lore of the Eldar. In this section, we pause the run through history and instead take a moment to explain who these powerful spiritual beings are that are now in charge of Arda, that's the world. I'll cover this in more depth in another video, but basically there are the 14 Valar, the most powerful of the beings, each of which has a special interest and powers in a particular area. For example, Ulmo is the Lord of Waters and King of the Sea. Yavanna is Queen of Earth, responsible for all things that grow. Their leader, and King of the Valar, is Manwë. It's worth noting that although these Valar have godlike powers and were there when Eru showed them the vision of the history of the world, they are neither omnipotent nor omniscient. They can see parts of the plan for the future in a hazy way, but not all of it. And although they are on the side of Eru and goodness and light, they are also not perfect. If you imagine a more rarefied version of the Norse or Greek pantheon of gods, you're not far off. Less powerful, but still immortal spiritual beings, are the Maiar. They support and assist the Valar in their duties. We don't know the names of all of them, but we do meet some of them in The Lord of the Rings. Gandalf, Saruman, and Sauron, for example. Which brings us to the enemies. We've already mentioned Morgoth, who is basically an evil Valar, but as he fell, he brought with him several Maiar. Sauron, of course, but also the Balrogs. So, after the first two sections of the book, the scene is set for when the action really kicks in part 3, Quenta Silmarillion, the history of the Silmarils. This is easily the largest part of the whole book, and its focus. It starts with the wars between Morgoth and the Valar. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing here, giant lamps getting knocked over, continents shattered and so on, but we end up with two important continents, Aman to the west, where the Valar are, and Middle-earth, where Morgoth has his home, and it is on Middle-earth where the elves awaken. This prompts the Valar back into action. They launch another war on Morgoth, and this time capture him, imprisoning him for 3 ages. Meanwhile, the Valar invite the elves to journey over to Aman to live with them. Many of them do, but some decide to stay where they are. And some decide to stop on the way. It's the start of many divisions between different types of elves. Anyway, many of the elves are now over in Aman and living in some kind of harmony, with light now being provided by 2 holy trees. All is well until Morgoth's imprisonment comes to an end. For a time, he pretends to be a reformed character, but his covetous eyes fall on the 3 Silmarils. The Silmarils are important for this part of the story, hence the book being called the Silmarillion. They are jewels crafted by an elf named Feanor that capture the holy light of those 2 trees of Valinor. Morgoth steals the jewels, and while he's at it, destroys the 2 trees of Valinor with the help of Ungoliant, a horrific spider-like light-eating monster. Morgoth makes his way back to his fortress in northern Middle-earth, leaving Valinor in darkness. Feanor, who made the Silmarils, leads his people over there en masse to try and reclaim the jewels. In so doing, he makes his sons swear an oath not to rest until the Silmarils are back in their possession. It is a fateful oath, as we'll see. Feanor himself doesn't get the Silmarils back. He rather rashly rushes ahead of his army and gets ambushed by some Balrogs. Ouch. But his sons and their people, the Noldor elves, have also arrived in Middle-earth and find that the elves they left behind there have now established kingdoms and civilizations. And not long after that, they discover that the second-born children of Ilúvatar, humans, have awakened and are spreading to the west. This is now what we know of as the First Age of Middle-earth. For a few hundred years, there was a sort of loose siege of Morgoth's fortress while he was, unknown to the outside world, building up his armies with new and horrific creations. This is when he first made dragons, for example. But finally Morgoth broke out, and region by region, stronghold by stronghold, the elves and humans fell before him. Indeed, many of the humans were corrupted onto his side. Eventually, Eärendil the sailor sailed for Aman to beg the intervention of the Valar. Against all hope, the Valar responded, coming in force to defeat Morgoth once more. That part of Middle-earth was sunk beneath the sea in the destruction, Morgoth captured and flung into the void, though some of his lieutenants, like Sauron, escaped. We can't talk about the First Age, though, without mentioning the 3 great tales Tolkien wove in there. Beren and Lúthien is the epic love story of a man, Beren, and an elf Lúthien who fell in love but were barred from marrying by Lúthien's father unless Beren could recover one of the Silmarils, which by this point were set into Morgoth's Iron Crown. Many adventures and much heroism followed before they managed it, though tragedy was to follow, as first some dwarves lusted after the Silmaril and committed atrocities to get it, then Feanor's sons, who had sworn that oath, remember, committed more atrocities in trying to get it themselves. The Children of Húrin is another tragedy, telling the story of Túrin Turambar and his sister Nienor, whose cursed fates entwine. It is perhaps Tolkien's bleakest work. Then The Fall of Gondolin tells the tale of the fall of the last great secret stronghold to Morgoth's forces. In case you are wondering about the fate of the Silmarils themselves, whose theft had led to all these events, the one Beren and Lúthien took ended up with their descendant Eärendil, who himself ended up in the night sky, a light offering hope to all. The other 2 were eventually claimed by Feanor's sons, though not for long. The ill deeds they had done caused the holy light within the Silmarils to burn their hands. One was flung into the fiery depths of the earth, the other into the sea. So that's the 3rd part of the book. As I said, it's the biggest, so I've skated over quite a lot of detail there. Part 4 is Akalabeth, the downfall of Numenor. The story of the Second Age, in other words. After the tumultuous end to the First Age, the world was reshaped again, and a new island continent given to the descendants of the humans who fought against Morgoth. Numenor grew to be powerful, the height of human civilization, but also slowly turned against the elves and the Valar. They grew jealous of the elves' immortality. Some remained true, the faithful, but most didn't. Meanwhile, Sauron emerged, challenging their power, but unexpectedly, he surrendered to them and allowed himself to be taken off to Numenor as a captive. From there, he slowly worked his way into the good graces of the king, Ar-Pharazôn, and fanned the flames of rebellion against the Valar themselves. They build a mighty fleet to invade the Undying Lands, but as soon as they land there, Eru himself intervenes, destroying the fleet and army and sinking Numenor back beneath the waves. Just the few faithful led by Elendil survive to form two new kingdoms in Middle-earth, Arnor in the north and Gondor in the south. Which brings us to the final part of the book, part 5, of The Rings of Power and the Third Age. This tells the familiar history of the forging of the Rings of Power, their distribution, the last alliance of elves and men, Sauron's defeat and Isildur's fall, the opening sequence of the Fellowship of the Ring film, basically. And it brings the story up to date, right up to the end of the story of the Lord of the Rings. So that's the Silmarillion, a background and history to the Lord of the Rings. Although, from Tolkien's perspective, it was really the other way around. The Lord of the Rings was an offshoot of this much greater work. The legendarium presented in the Silmarillion is a work of decades, a lifetime. As Tolkien himself said in a letter to his publishers, his aim had always initially been to create a body of more or less connected legend, ranging from the large and cosmogonic to the level of romantic fairy story. The larger founded on the lesser in contact with the earth, the lesser drawing splendour from the vast backcloths. If The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings are the romantic fairy stories, then the Silmarillion is the vast backcloth from which they draw their splendour. If you'd like more videos diving deep into Tolkien's legendarium, there's a playlist appearing now on the left of your screen. Or if you'd like to support this channel, thank you. There's a link to my Patreon page on the right of the screen. That's all for this time. Thanks for watching. I'll see you again soon.